This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
The neighbors chose this morning to clean their deck, so it's raining outside, basically. Even so, it's kind of quiet in here. And by in here, I also mean in here, and not just me, but all of you, too. May take some time for us to appreciate that particular quiet, but it's definitely worth it. As soon as you open your mouth, there's the possibility of misleading people. So sometimes I think it's better if I never say anything, but that's a little too zen. Speaking of quiet in this way may make it sound like there's something over there somewhere. Hiding under a rock or something. The actual teaching is that sound itself is quiet. It's hard to say whether, in order to appreciate that, you need to have a lot of confidence in Buddha's teaching and in Dharma practice, or if having confidence is a way to appreciate these deep teachings that Shakyamuni Buddha left us, or is giving us. Our Zen stories seem to be, not always, but very often, the characters seem to have tremendous confidence in Buddha's teaching. And of course, most of them grew up with it. We were raised in an environment where Buddha's teaching was basically everywhere. But most of us haven't had that particular experience. So, like many of you, I was raised Judeo-Christian. So I sometimes think my appreciation of Dharma always has a little bit Roman Catholic flavor to it. That used to bother me, but not anymore. It bothered me before I notice that Dharma in its true sense is completely pervasive and has nothing to do with the boundaries between faiths as they're humanly conceived. So, therefore, this quiet is our human treasure universally. And Buddha's teaching keeps kind of trying to turn us that way and away from building more and more elaborate, more sandcastles, really, that the tide will inevitably sweep away. And the main sandcastle, of course, is called me. And usually, most of us, myself included, we're pretty heavily invested in that real estate. And so when we notice that the tide is sweeping that away, usually when we see that our investments are threatened, we get a little upset. This investment in real estate is no different. So Shakyamuni Buddha taught that this tide that's sweeping everything away is very quiet. Sometimes if you are rather still, you can, so to speak, you can hear the tide sweeping in and out. And it's quite peaceful. I don't mean literally exactly, something like that. So one of the dangers, one of the pitfalls, of course, is quiet can become quietism. And as some of our Zen friends on the other side of the aisle, so to speak, have wagged fingers at us. You're quietists. Boo. So... but then we should reply, actually, we're aware of that pitfall. Thank you very much for taking care of our practice. We know about that. Quietism is just, you know, it's kind of like quiet for quiet's sake. And it's, well, it's just the kind of meditative equivalent of a good slug of scotch or something. So that's actually not that helpful. Because that quietism is caught up in the dualistic mind. And the dualistic mind is a powerful and important tool, but usually the way it functions is taken to be an explanation of reality. And then trouble ensues. So to allow quiet to be cultivated without sliding into quietism requires a little, well, really just some attention. I'm particularly prone to that pitfall because I liked peace and quiet anyway. So noisy neighbors tend to ruffle my feathers a little bit. So I'm already into peace and quiet. So when I heard about meditation, I thought, oh, that's even a better way to get into peace and quiet. So I have to be careful not to be a quietist. And then, as we've been warned, if we're quietistic, then what we have in our practice is somebody called a meditation cult. And sometimes if you study the way Soto Zen is presented, it can sound like a meditation cult. What does that mean? Well, usually a cult means that there's a certain collection of sometimes artifacts and certain behaviors that are themselves the point of the practice or the observance. They don't, point beyond themselves at all. Sometimes this is called fetishism, where certain objects are invested with what the psychoanalysts anyway called libidinal energy. So the way we avoid that pitfall is by making sure that the context of our cultivating quiet is the study of the self. That most important sandcastle piece of real estate. And of course, Dogen makes this famous and somewhat perplexing remark that the more you study the self, the more you forget it. And Sigurashi used to say sometimes, you know, older students will know what I mean, but you know, if I say that, then some people may think, oh, I'm not an older student, and get depressed. So I don't want to put it that way. It's just that stuff in practice that at one point seems very enigmatic, at another point ceases to be. So this notion that studying the self could actually be a route to forgetting the self makes profound sense. Because the more you look, the more carefully you examine this person, the less you see there. And the more the quiet seems to subsume everything. And this person is just something that happens, I don't know, you could almost say on the border between form and emptiness. But unfortunately, if you say that, then it starts to sound like there are two territories, one called form and one called emptiness. But that's not the case. So things being the way they are, sometimes the only thing that makes sense is just to, well, give up. And I think maybe if, you know, if you're a very advanced practitioner, that giving up could look like anything. There's that Zen guy who's like a clown, you know, professional clown. He kind of got tired of all of the Zen stuff, so he became a clown. And, that I think that's pretty advanced. And I personally cannot claim such advancement, so I'm still this Zen person. Maybe I'll get over that at some point. But right now, my way of giving up is just somebody taught me various things to do, so I just do them. Most of the time, I think I get away from, as I've probably said too many times, practice as lever. You know? I'm going to stick this lever under my life and make it something really cool by leaning on it. And sometimes we start to treat practice that way, and then usually it gets kind of frustrating. So our sitting practice embodies this simultaneous giving up and studying the self by, as we've said, utilizing the body-mind's balance. And with attention, like a sort of gentle radiance, filling the body mind, we simply attend to the waves, the tide coming in and out. And something extraordinary happens. But it's so extraordinary that you can't grasp it, which is good, because if we could grasp it, by golly, we would. And then, as Buddha taught, well, there you go, more suffering. So with this noise as background, we can appreciate the quiet. And the noise itself is the tide flowing in and out. One of the peculiar things we do is one of the things I was taught to do as a way of giving up is we do stuff like make offerings and burn incense and do bows and chanting. So I've been doing that since I was a teenager, so I'm kind of used to it now. If you're new to it, it may seem very strange, but really, you can be confident that it's just a way of giving up. And ironically, giving up invites total presence, total body-mind presence, because you're not going anywhere else. There's no leverage available at all. This means automatically you're wholeheartedly in practice without trying to make that happen. to appreciate that some degree of repetition is actually helpful. So in Japan, they really, really stress that. So you wind up doing the same things over and over again for years, year after year. Something extraordinary happens. So next we're going to do one of those things that we do around the full moon every month. Make some offerings and do some chanting and once again admire the Bodhisattva path, predicated upon liberation for every being. So there's this ceremony that's part gratitude and part commitment. And you're all invited to stay for that if you want. We have some new toys to play with. So that red tower-like thing on the side altar back there. We just got some stuff from Japan, courtesy of Sangha members' generosity. So we have some new toys. Well, I don't know. I always wonder whether what I say makes any sense or not, but at some point I learned I just had to say it. It sounds like nonsense to people, then so be it. And they will vote with their feet, as they say. Apparently in Korea, that's very common. I didn't realize, but if the monks at a monastery, if they don't like the abbot, they'll just leave. Just walk out one day, go somewhere else. Well, that's one way to do it, I guess. Apparently that was the case once where there was like a Western monk who was at one of the Korean monasteries and was having a terrible time with the diet because everything had all of this chili in it. It's just like roasting hot, all of it. It was totally upsetting his stomach. So he asked the abbot, could he maybe have it on the side instead? And the abbot said, yeah, all right. But the monks were furious. So each meal there'd be this little demonstration where they'd take the chili pepper and go dump it into their food, you know. And some of them just upped and left. They didn't want their food messed with. Okay, well, that's one way to do things. So anyway, y'all can leave if you want. But meanwhile, maybe if you have a question or a comment, please feel free. Yes?
I have two quick comments. One, you're saying you don't know if you should say anything at all, and I certainly would be okay with it as long as you learn to play the flute with a basket or do somersaults or some other fantastical Dharma teaching thing.
Okay.
And we were watching, I think I've mentioned this before, the documentary of the Catholic monks in France. And why do I always forget where they're from? Chantreux or something, that monastery in France. And I remember being surprised at how similar that looked to our practice. It looked, to me, almost like the same thing.
Yes, this is no accident.
And then my last comment will be quiet is I think this stuff that you're talking about is really difficult. I was noticing that I think I was telling you earlier, we were just at the Redwoods, and I get so angry at people for not being quiet in the Redwoods.
Yeah.
I'm always want to go around and sort of correct them, because I think, well, here you are around these beautiful trees that have been around over 1,000 years, and I see you stomping through, not even looking at them, and talking about work and your daily life.
Don't they realize it's a cathedral?
Yeah, I get so angry, and I think about it, and I'm like, well, I don't get angry at the birds that are chirping the whole time, and I don't get angry at weather when it makes its noise, but I sure get angry at people and find myself trying to enforce that quiet too all the time on others.
Well, when I was able to, more fully to recognize pervasive quality of faith and silence, and I started going to Catholic Mass again, and I was quite bugged by the fact that people before and even during the service were chatting, wiggling around and looking at their phones and reading stuff, and I actually really disliked it, so I stopped going, because I thought, if this isn't supposed to be a contemplative experience, then what is the point? So I too have this little tendency, and if somehow my practice opportunities are reduced to quietism only, it's like, well, all right, I'm okay with that. It doesn't happen. We'll see.
That was, I think that Pendo experienced the same thing. He went back to his Latter-day Saint thing. And
yeah.
He said, I was shocked. Everyone was on their phone, and kids were calling all over, and people were talking, and people were sleeping. And you do kind of wonder, like, why do you get up in the morning and walk, you know, or drive or go to these places?
But now, it's worth saying that, for instance, at some of the Tibetan ceremonies, there's a different feeling. And often there are kids running in and out, and people eating and talking and stuff. But the sense is a little different, because the efficacy of the ceremony is so powerful that it doesn't really matter if people are running in and out. The monks are very quiet and they're concentrated, and that is kind of spreading out and engulfing everybody. But I don't think didn't feel like in the church that's what was going on. So I don't know. I shouldn't complain. My brother, as you know, is a Catholic priest, and I love him dearly. And he has some of the same feeling, though. You know, it's like he's up there performing the Mass, and like, where is everybody? You know, they're all doing God knows what. You know, it's like, pay attention. What else is our life for? Otherwise. Yeah.
It is kind of like these sacred places or the famed places are kind of like a mandala, and there's many doorways in. And some people need to wiggle and chirp. And then you're right about the Tibetan Vajrayana things, because there is more of this sound being used, like the power washer, but you know, more things to build up the sound field and drums.
Right,
and
yeah. It's very powerful. Yes.
About Dogen's quote there.
Yes. My foot's going to sleep. I have to put my pretzel here. Yes, sorry. Go ahead.
To study the self is to forget the self. And then there's a couple of lines afterwards. To forget the self is to become one with myriad things.
Oh, well, to be awakened by all things.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Was he suggesting that if one truly does forget the self, phenomena would somehow just come to us in a way that would be somewhat different than what we usually experience?
Well, actually what he's saying is that phenomena already do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the study of the self will facilitate our appreciation of that. Because otherwise, again, we're waiting for some special thing to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite misleading. Because all things that happen are special. And being awakened by all things is sort of to position the body-mind as though that were true. So some people call that, just fake it till you make it, man. It's like, I always find that sounds a little coarse to me. It's not about faking it. Either we kind of think that Buddha was right in his description of reality, or we don't. If we don't, then, well, that's all right, find another faith. But if you do, why not align the body as though that were true, as though what he said was a genuine insight, and not just Shakyamuni Buddha, but women and men practitioners over the last 2.5 millennia. So naturally, there's some tendency to think that, like I just said, what I say is something like, something extraordinary will happen, as though I meant like a cool thing will fall upon us from somewhere. It's like, any second now, a cool thing will happen. That's not what I meant. Right? What's extraordinary is what's happening now. And we've spent so long not appreciating that, that it takes a little while for our sensibility to see that we move with that tide and that we aren't anything other than that tide moving out. Just takes a little while, that's all. But eventually, all of the 10,000 things will remind us. That's extraordinary. Okay, well, maybe some of you would like to have a little bit different practice involving bowing and scraping and stuff. In which case, please stay for a little while and then join us for tea afterwards. Let's see, is there anything remarkable on the calendar coming up to report? Do we have a
20, I think it's like 20 something is the next guest speaker, Laura Burgess.
Later this month.
Yeah.
Yeah, so later this month, Laura Burgess will give the Dharma talk.
Yeah, little Saturday. Yeah.
And the Monday after Easter will be closed, so you won't have to get up early.
When's Easter?
Easter is the 20th, I believe. So Monday the 21st will be closed. Yes?
And we'll be speaking at City Center.
Oh, Lord.
April 24th.
That's right. I forgot about that.
An advanced Buddhist studies course.
Yeah. God knows.
Advanced.
Yes. I'm going to try to make it advanced, but I don't know how I'm going to do that. So anyway, I'm supposed to be talking about the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor, so we'll try to come up with something.
The time?
7:30.
Yeah. This is Thursday the 24th over there at 300 Page.
If you're interested, you go to their site and reserve a spot on their little.
Yes,
they
do
that now. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Do that now.
I guess they're selling tickets or something.
Yes.
Bear in mind, I'm not usually good box office, so I hope they know that. They probably know that. Okay. Thank you all very much.